I'm Christopher Lydon with a successor to Dryden, Wordsworth, Tennyson, and Ted Hughes as Britain's Poet Laureate. Andrew Motion can sound like the elegist of rural old imperial England, but he can sting in the present tense too on matters from Princess Di to the scream of rocket burn in the war in Iraq. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. In our series, Whose Words These Are, on the practice of poetry today, Andrew Motion speaks for the far shore of the two peoples separated by a common language. In George Bernard Shaw's line, the common questions here are the ones I've been asking of a score of American poets this fall of 2009. How is the estate of poetry, this community of poetry these days? How do practitioners of every style and standing connect with the ancestors? How do they connect with each other? Are they speaking to us in their books, in their readings, or on the internet? Do we know what we're looking for from poets today, and do we know how to get it? Andrew Motion, we're delighted to welcome you. You have used the phrase harrowing clarity to define your goal as you write. Would you get us started by just showing us what you mean by that harrowing clarity in a poem, a signature poem, perhaps?
Well, it's a great pleasure to be talking to you, so that's the first thing to say. And of course, I'm delighted to do that. The phrase comes from a little poem I wrote a long time ago now. In fact, one of the very first poems that makes it into my selected poems, which opens with a small group of poems about an accident that my mother suffered when I was in my sort of mid-teens. We might come back to that, but I thought that it would be helpful to immediately put that phrase in context. And also because the poem that I'm going to read you comes from this early part of my writing life and is indeed a poem about my mother, and it's a little poem called In the Attic.
Ah, yes.
I think what I really meant by harrowing clarity, I mean, she, though very ill for a long time, had a way of piercing the people who went to see her and the people she loved, both in a metaphorical sense, with the way that she looked at us, but also because of the sympathy that we felt for her condition. And I think around that phrase, it's perhaps helpful if I say something like, I've always wanted to write poems which looked very simple but turned out not to be as simple as they seemed. In other words, to use a very unshowy, unostentatious, unpeculiar language, but one which nevertheless needs to get the reader by the throat in some way in order to make the impact that I would like it to make. Or to put all this in terms of an image, I've always wanted to write poems which look like a glass of water but turn out to be gin.
That's good.
Anyway, here's this little poem called In the Attic, which I wrote when I was, I think, about 19 years old. Even though we know now your clothes will never be needed, we keep them upstairs in a locked trunk. Sometimes I kneel there, touching them, trying to relive time you wore them, to catch the actual shape of arm and wrist. My hands push down between hollow, invisible sleeves, hesitate, then take hold and lift. A green holiday, a red christening, all your unfinished lives fading through dark summers, entering my head as dust.
There's so many poems in your book about your mother's death and accident. And I wonder, would you tell us the story concisely and then maybe read some of those anniversary poems?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a little village on the borders of the counties of Essex and Suffolk, which is part of East Anglia. If you look at the map of the UK and see that bulge in the bottom right-hand corner, it's sort of in the middle of all that.
Where the Puritans came from, I mean, where the
That's
Mayflower
right.
came from.
Yes, and where many remain.
Yeah.
And in a little village that my father's family had lived in for several generations, doing middle-class rural things. I mean, my childhood was not a bookish one at all, and in a sense, nothing wrong with that, but just to sort of make the observation that it wasn't a bookish one. My father, with a sort of comical reverse boastfulness, used to claim that he'd read half a book in his life. This matters to me because It makes me feel that my life is one that I made rather than one that I inherited, and that seems an important thing to be able to feel about one's own existence. And what this really meant in terms of how we spent our time was that my brother and I and my mother and father in our in the happy pre-accident times used to, well, be nice to animals if they were domesticated and try and murder them in due seasonal rotation if they were not domesticated. It was that kind of childhood. And so it sort of, in a way, fits, if this thing must be spoken about in those sorts of terms, that the accident that my mother had was, in fact, a riding accident. She fell off, bashed her head, and then spent them 3 years profoundly unconscious. I mean, quite an unusually long length of time, living in a strange no woman's land, no man's land between life and death, from which she eventually slowly surfaced into a place which was more articulate. She could speak a little bit, but immobile, and she never left hospital, and that went on for a further 6 years. So it was a long, almost decade of her being in this peculiar situation. And I started writing poems at more or less the same time as the accident happened. I had just begun before the accident happened, but I think it's almost inevitable, given all that. And I don't want to embarrass your listeners by taking them through it in more detail than I need to do. But I think it perhaps is quite helpful to sketch it at least, because it suggests some very early and primitive link between thinking about suffering and thinking about a sort of intermediacy, a sort of, as I say, a kind of not quite belonging in life and not quite belonging in death either, that has become the, I think inevitably, has become the way in which, well, both this, an important part of the subject and in a sense an important part of how I feel about my own experience too, as somebody observing it in a way which has perhaps been a bit detached from its flow by thinking about suffering. Anyway, that's how I put it to myself. And as I was saying a minute ago, quite a lot of the early poems in this book and then others dotted through it are about her. So I'll read you maybe one or two from the little sequence that follows from the poem I've just read, the poem called In the Attic. And this is a poem called Anniversaries, which I wrote about 3 or 4 years into her illness.
Please.
I'll just read the very first, which is actually confusingly called the fourth, because it begins at the end and then runs through the years in between. Anniversary weather. I drive under a raw sunset, the road cramped between drifts, hedges polished into sharp crests. I have it by heart now. On this day, in each year, no signposts point anywhere but east into Essex, and so to your ward, where snow recovers tonight the ground I first saw lost 4 winters ago. Whatever time might bring, all my journeys take me back to this dazzling dark. I watch my shadow ahead, plane across open fields, out of my reach forever, but setting towards your bed to find itself waiting there. And then perhaps, in order to try and make sense of reading something from a sequence, I should read the last one, which is also set on that same day. The evening falls with snow beginning again, halving the trees into whiteness, driving me with it towards the end of another year. What will the next one bring that this has already abandoned? You are your own survivor, giving me back the world I knew without the years we lost. Until I forget whatever it cannot provide, I'll always arrive like this, having no death to mourn, but rather the life we share nowhere beyond your room. Our love repeating itself like snow I watch tonight, which pauses on my window, then flounces into the dark. It's rather odd for me to read these very early poems, because even though the experience they describe is one which has remained with me with an extraordinary degree of vividness for all the reasons you can readily imagine, they are, simply in terms of time passing, poems that I wrote in some cases, 30, 35 years ago. So it's going back quite a long time.
Andrew Motion, these are very powerful poems from a very young man in a strange, disconcerted life, just beginning. I always ask our poets, what got you started? Who told you you had to be a poet or you could be a poet? You had sort of faced that question before this accident, and suddenly you had this huge emotion to deal with. But tell us how all of these things made the poet.
I'm fairly clear in my own mind how I was led into poetry, because even though there is always an element of the mysterious about these things, there are two ways in which I can be quite categoric about it. One is to do with the very thing that we've been talking about, which is this accident having happened and my trying to seize on a way of, in some sense, making sense of it. Mm-hmm. But I think that alone might not have done the trick. What happened at more or less exactly the same time is that I started, and this is a sort of story which I'm sure that other people will have told you in their own different ways, but at more or less while all this was going on, I started to be taught English in school by somebody who'd not taught me before, a brilliant and in himself very unshowy man, but really somebody who walked straight into my head and turned all the lights on.
This is Mr. Way.
This is the great Mr. Way, yes. Ah, well, yeah. Great to me, Mr. Way. Anyway, how nice of you to remember his name, and nice to be mentioning it here too. I mean, he's still alive, Mr. Way. He's an old man now and has become a very dear friend of mine over the years, as you might imagine.
Take us into class with him, with you.
Well, what happened was that on the very first day, I mean, bearing in mind all the things that I've already been mentioning to you about not very few books in my background and so on and so forth, I sat down with some skepticism in the first English classroom that I found myself in with him, thinking, not quite poetry, schmoetry, but certainly thinking, what's this got to do with me? I mean, it's a classic sort of boy's reaction to it, and we can... every which way you turn, you can see boys, unfortunately, feeling the same way about it now. anyway, I mean, boys in particular, by which I mean to imply. But he very quickly stepped through that. He gave us to read a poem by Thomas Hardy called I Look Into My Glass. I look into my glass and view my wasting skin. He means mirror, looking glass, not drinking glass. Mm. A slightly odd poem to give to a room full of probably refusenik 15, 16-year-olds. But it certainly did the trick for me, both in terms of immediately engaging my interest in the subject, which is it's a poem, as you probably remember, in which Hardy remembers a young man's longings, desires in an old man's body. I mean, we weren't old men, very far from it, in fact. But nevertheless, there was something about recognizing the urgency of the thing that he was grieving for, not being able to express anymore, that I found instantly very moving. And what I particularly liked was the way that Hardy's language in that poem, and this is pretty typical of Hardy's language throughout, although it does have strong characteristics which allow us over time and familiarity to be pretty sure that we're dealing with a poem by Hardy rather than somebody else, there is a lack of showiness about it which appealed to me very much. I think that because it was all such strange stuff for me, the lack of show in it, the lack of oddity, made it feel immediately more familiar than it might have done if he'd given us a poem by Hopkins to read, if you see what I'm saying. I think its sort of proximity to ordinary speech was reassuring to me. And then on top of that, the idea that he was writing about things which any person with eyes in their head could see out of the window, that was reassuring too. It immediately, in other words, made me understand that poetry need not necessarily be a strange addition to life, a weird bolt-on, but absolutely part of ordinary life. Mm. And that by looking hard and clearly at ordinary life, what is miraculous about it becomes visible. So the miraculousness of the ordinary is, I think, what Hardy, as presented to me by Mr. Way, whom I struggle to call Peter Way, but that is his full name, allowed me to understand.
That miraculous and the ordinary, I mean, that comes back in your own work and a lot of poems that you could read, but maybe we should just jump, you know, cut to the chase and ask you to read The Mower, the title poem of this book, which
seems to be about your father, and it has a lot of sort of both the ordinary and the miraculous about it.
Well, I'd be delighted to do that, and it seems a natural thing to do, given that we've been talking about my mama. We should get my dad into the frame here as well.
Yes.
My father lived for much longer than my mother, and died 3 and a bit years ago in his mid-80s. And what immediately happened after his death, I'd been up in East Anglia with him while all that was going on, and then came back to my flat in London, where my partner and I live in North London. It was late spring, early summer, while all this was going on. And partly because I wanted to take my mind off things and partly because it looked as though it needed doing, I mowed what my other half and I cheerily call our lawn, which, because we're in the middle of London, is actually a tiny, looks like a folded handkerchief. But as I came in from doing it, which took all of a minute, I was really saturated by a memory of watching my father mow the lawn when my brother Kit and I were children, and just went straight through into my writing room and pretty much wrote it down there and then. We had a very much bigger garden back then when we were growing up. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that we lived in a grand house. We didn't, but it had a big sort of country garden. And my father had rather mixed feelings about mowing the lawn. Part of him, being a tidy-minded man, liked imposing order and bringing nature to heel, so to say. And part of him felt rather exasperated by the humongous great machine that we had back then. This is the late 1950s, made by the company of Ransom. And really a machine with a mind of its own that used to drag him around the place, flattening all kinds of things that he had no intention of going anywhere near. So when we were watching him from the kitchen window, we could see his sort of rising fury about this, but at the same time, this pleasure in imposing order. So here's this poem, which, like a lot of elegies, is called The Mower. With stormlight in the east but no rain yet, I came in from mowing my square of lawn and paused in the doorway to glance round at my handiwork and the feckless apple blossom, blurring those trim stripes and hover sweeps I had meant to last. What I saw instead was you, in threadbare cords, catching the sunny interval between showers, trundling the ransom out from its corner in the woodshed. The dizzy whiff of elm chips and oil, joke shop spider threads greying the rubber handles, gravel pips squeaking as the roller squashed through the yard. Then a hush, like the pause before thunder, while you performed your ritual of muffled curses and forehead wipes, your pessimistic tugs on the starter cable, more curses, more furious yanks, until at long last the engine sulked, recovered, sighed a grey cloud speckled with petrol bits, and wobbled into a roar. Off came the brake, and off charged the machine, dragging you down to the blazing tree of heaven at the garden end, where the trick was to reverse without stalling or scraping a hefty mud crescent before you careered back towards Kit and me at our place in the kitchen window, out of your way. To and fro, to and fro, to and fro, to and fro, and each time a few feet more to the left, sometimes lifting one hand in a hasty wave which said, "Stay put," but also, "I'm in charge." Although we understood from the way your whole body lurched lopsided on the turn, this was less than 100% true. Getting the job done was all we ever wanted. Part with our cricket things and happy enough to wait, since experience had taught us that after you'd unhooked the big green metal grass basket, splodged with its royal appointment transfer, lugged it off to the smoking heap by the compost, thumped it empty, then reappeared to give us the thumbs up, we were allowed to burst suddenly out like dogs into the sweet air, measure the pitch between our studious stump plantings, toss to see who went in first, then wait for you to turn up again from the woodshed, where you had taken 5 minutes to switch the petrol off, and wipe the blades down, and polish the grass basket, although it never would shine up much, being what you called venerable. You always did come back. That was the thing. As you also come back now in the week you died, just missing the first thick gusts of rain and the last of the giddy apple blossom falling into your footprints, with bright grass flecks on your shoes and trouser legs, carefree for the minute, and young, and fit for life, but cutting clean through me then vanishing for good?
It is elegiac, as you say, not only about an old man with a with a venerable but fading moor. It strikes me as one of the identifying marks of your poetry, and strangely, one of the differences between most American poetry these days. We're not, I don't know, not yet given to this sort of nostalgia and this sense of England at evening that, that runs through a lot of your poems.
Well, I'm very pleased you say that because I'm, of course, aware that a lot of the subjects of my poems are, on the face of it, very personal. They're poems about my partner, their poems about my childhood, their poems, and my mother in particular, their poems about my father, their poems about, as it were, what happened to what happens to me in a rolling way. But I've always thought that the very large amount of my time that I spend engaged with the political things around my writing is evident here in the sense of exactly what you've just described, Willie, which is a sense of England mutating from one being one kind of society into another one. I don't want to give the impression that I'm sort of lingeringly, damp, idly peering back at a golden age and wishing that it would come back again. That's very much not my political position. I feel very engaged with the here and now. But I, as I say that, I also feel very struck, of course, by living at the moment where the old imperial idea of the UK gave way to something else.
It comes through very strongly in, a, in another poem about your father called Veteran. Would you want to read that?
Yes, if you don't mind me reading another poem which goes on over the page in Larkin's terrifying phrase.
No, we can take it.
Good, okay. Well, I think, I mean, in a sense, a lot of the things that we're talking about here and intimating here are rather crystallized in the figure of my father, a person who did find it quite difficult to live in the here and now in the last part of his life. And I want to say again that I don't have that difficulty, but he did have that difficulty. And a lot of it was to do with the time that he spent as a soldier, both during and then in the Territorial Army after the Second World War. My father joined up in 1940 and took part in the D-Day landings quite close to Omaha Beach, actually, on Gold Beach, which is one of the adjacent ones to Omaha.
Yes.
And in June 2004, he and I went back together, and he took me around some of the places. He had been back in the interval between the war ending and the time that we went there together. But like a lot of men of his generation, he was extremely reluctant to talk to me about what happened in the war. When I was a child, I used to think this was because it wasn't very interesting. Maybe nothing much had happened to him, as it were. But as I got older, of course, I realized that he was quiet about it because he didn't want the grief of all that to fall like a shadow across my life. So it was rather continuingly courageous of him, if you like, to
if I may say, before you read it, it also strikes me, especially the D-Day connection. I mean, it is an entirely shared cause and battle between the Brits and the Yanks, and yet your poem and your father's experience seem so entirely unlike the classic American poem or movie or memory.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, quite often, of course, and this has attracted some comment, quite a lot of the American movies that you see about the D-Day landings, including Saving Private Ryan, you wouldn't know the Brits were there. So there is a kind
of... Well, we barely admit that the Russians were there on the other front
That's also true.
Fair play.
But I mean that in a sort of amused way rather than any other. But that's only part of what you mean, I think, in putting that question. I mean, I'm not, probably not familiar with the detail of what the American rendering of this experience is like, but I'm certainly aware in a broad way of how different this poem probably is to a lot of the American responses that you have in mind as you say what you do say there.
Yeah.
It's perhaps helpful for people listening if I say that this poem, although it speaks about my father's experiences in France, actually is not set there. It's set in this village that I was mentioning right at the beginning of our conversation, the village I grew up in and the one that he and his family have lived in for such a long time now. And it's written in as your listeners will very quickly realize, in quatrains, in which the second and fourth lines and the first and the third lines rhyme. So it's pretty tight. But having said that, these rhymes are quite off a lot of the time. They part rhyme, or they are assonantal rather than being full rhymes. I find as I get older that although I enjoy writing rhyming poems, full rhymes I have less and less interest in using, and more interest in writing poems which only half rhyme. Anyway, enough said. It's called Veteran. This visit to my father's house ends with the two of us side by side at his kitchen window, in silence facing the old view. Across the field, the wood shudders under lilac cloud, which a while ago was a bird and is now a shroud. Draping the winter trees with filigree rain gauze, a handful of sun flukes gilding the drab trunks. My father and I watch. Are we about to catch a burst of orange afterglow? Or will the evening go headlong down tonight? With the sad weight of a man dragging chains, he has managed to remain on track through his tour of flashbacks from the war. 3 fog-soaked years of square bashing and canvas, the sick flat-bottom dash of D-Day, the frothy wash of waves inside his tank as it declined to sink, the hell-for-leather advance when the lanes of France shrank bottle-tight, blazing, the ash wreck of Berlin. This is by heart, of course, all at his own pace. Now dust has settled again, and fear, grief, boredom, pain have found out how to fade into the later life he made. But I still look at him, the way his eyes take aim and hold the wood in focus, just in case anonymous and twilight-baffled trees might in fact be enemies advancing. I look up at him and cannot estimate the harm still beating in his head, but hidden in his words. What might he have done? What might I have done, frightened for my life, to make my future safe? Did he kill a man? Did he fire the gun with this crumpled finger, which now lifts and lingers on the swimming glass, and points out how the mass of cloud above the wood has melted from a shroud into a carnival mask? I never dare to ask. I would rather not show the appetite to know how much of his own self he shattered on my behalf. He is my father, and from him all I gather are things that he allows, turning from the window before the sinking sky has buried the wood entirely, and telling him it's time I headed off for home, while he still stares outside and waits for the parade of shadow shapes to end, his slightly lifted hand either showing I should stay or pushing me away.
Which was it at the end? I'm sorry.
Well, I was only going to say, I think that demonstrates quite clearly the thing we were talking about before I started reading it, of how the kind of social dimension to this, the Second World War, rather, marking a quite distinct change in British cultural life and its authority in the world and so on and so forth. All that I wanted to embed in the figure of my father there.
Yes.
It would be, I mean, so in a sense one could say, well, it's a poem about an old-fashioned man, and so it is, but it is in that old-fashionedness, there's a very complicated set of social and political currents flowing, I think.
Well, so many elements of these poems seem to push and pull or look both ways. He's beckoning you back. He's bidding you go.
Well, the question of yours that I interrupted there, which I think was going to be, which is he doing? I mean, the truth is, I'm not quite sure. I mean, a bit of him wants to pull me back and be like him, but I resist that, of course, in myself. But also he's pushing me away because he realizes that the world that I live in is my world, and that I'm not going to react to it in the same way that he himself did.
It resonates with Langdon Hammer's observation in introducing your poems that there's a feeling here that involves a turning away from modernity and modernization, but implies for the same reason a specifically modern attitude that you embody.
Very pleased that he says that.
Yeah, it's a bit of a paradox, but we can hear it. Andrew Motion, would you go back to Mr. Hayes' classroom in which he introduced you to what we would call the canon? And I'm fascinated with American poets, but I'm fascinated talking to American poets by which bits of Wallace Stevens or Whitman or Dickinson or Tennyson or Homer, for that matter,
indeed,
become their touchstones. But there's another funny difference between these two English-speaking countries. Your list of canonical guides is different from the outset, and I wish you just sort of sketch them. What was the neighborhood of poets that you were being introduced to as a 14-year-old?
Well, that's a very nice question, and it's one which I spend quite a lot of time thinking about, of course, because a lot of the people that I met way back then are still the people that I hold dearest. Well, through that sort of tutelage that I was getting then, I first read the little group of poets who are absolutely the top of my tree still. So that's Wordsworth, Thomas Hardy, we've already mentioned.
Mm.
Some Tennyson, early Tennyson in particular, I read and liked very, very much. Edward, the great poet, the great First World War poet, Edward Thomas, who is not nearly as well known over here in the US as he is in the UK, except perhaps as the friend of Robert Frost. And through my reading of Edward Thomas, whom I later wrote a book about, and indeed did my graduate thesis on, through reading Thomas, getting to know Robert Frost, a poet I absolutely love. And coming more up to date, I'd have to say something about Philip Larkin there too, whom I've written about a lot and who was a friend of mine in the last part of his life. Larkin became a very important person for me. And I want to throw in Elizabeth Bishop there too. I mean, Bishop and Frost are very interesting, I think, in the context that we're talking about here, because you can hear in both their poems things which suit a sort of classic idea of what the English ear might enjoy listening to. They, that's to say, they're formally pretty orthodox, they're extremely watchful, their language is intense but not ornate. All the things that, in fact, we've been touching on in response to your earlier questions. And I suppose those people would still really constitute my most sort of regular reading. Their poems and poets that I go back to absolutely endlessly, and particularly Wordsworth. Wordsworth is the sort of main man for me.
Mm.
And I think you can probably guess why, which is that he is, again, particularly in the earlier part of his writing life, absolutely a genius at making personal feelings and personal observations carry a load of political and social significance. And that sort of idea of writing went in very deeply.
You remind me in some funny way of Donald Hall, who has been a U.S. poet laureate.
Yes, that's right, whom I've met and admire.
Yeah, and like you, he is deep into quotidian experience, rural life, intensely conscious of his family tree, both real and literary. But I'd also like you to read the great poet of New England in our memory, Robert Frost. You have a poem. Talk about Robert Frost, and I'd love you to read it.
Well, I'd be delighted to do that. I can't really praise Frost highly enough. I admire him so much.
Well, give us an idea why.
Well, these beautifully made, again, unshowy but very intense poems describing people's relationship with one another and in particular with landscape tell eternal truths about our relationship with one another and with our environment. And I'm using that word very advisedly because I think now that we're so preoccupied by worrying about the environment, Frost's poems have, if you like, sort of developed a whole new dimension to them because they're so attentive to things in nature. It's very difficult to read even the ones which celebrate things in nature now without feeling at a kind of layer of elegy has been added to them because how much longer is this stuff going to be here for us to enjoy? Well, we have a new sense of its fragility, at least. So I think those are the sort of fundamental reasons for it. And if I can just set up this poem by saying a couple of things about it. It's an eclogue, which is, of course, a form that he liked. So there's an element of homage in this. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it after I'd given a reading somewhere in England. And I'd said during the course of the reading that I liked Frost very much. And somebody came up to me afterwards and said, had I ever met him? Which would have been difficult. I was nine when Frost died. I mean, I could have met him, but it would have been, given my background and so on, it would have been rather unlikely. But, of course, like a lot of people, when they ask such a question, he wanted me to listen to the story that he had to tell about meeting Frost, which was really the story that I then told in this poem. Mm. He'd met Frost when he was a student. Frost had been off studying, reading in some cabin extension of the university that he was a part of. And Frost had come and given a reading, and this had happened. So talk about Robert Frost. Did you ever hear Frost read? Once, north of Boston, in my final year, some friends and I had gone weekending in the woods, 2 days of reading, fending for ourselves, and one professor sort of taking charge. He'd known Frost from way back, and so Frost came, or blew in, rather, through the cabin door. You must have thought. I thought I'd seen the face of God. Old Testament, of course. The windswept hair, the kindly uncle face, which might be harsh. I couldn't tell what trouble he had known, or how near death he was. He looked so happy, I could say. Blithe is what I mean. And he read what? Extraordinary, familiar things. It made me think of how a baker might pass round the loaves he'd just pulled from the oven. Warm, they felt. And that was all? Not only that. As he read on, a storm brewed up and filled the world behind him. Daylight failed. Wind dropped. The first few snowbuds blossomed on the silver birch, and we could feel it drawing close. Was Frost put off? He never heard. But there, behind him in the window, there it was. And you? We held our circle as we had to do, all watching him, he thought, all keeping step, while he'd trod backwards through his own old snow, and came and went through sundry other trees. But losing him, in fact, some out to meet the storm, some inwards, taking cover where we could. Like him, you mean? You could say that. Like him. Except, I told you, he had no idea, or none, until the weather reached us. Then he knew.
You summon him up.
Well, that's sweet of you to say.
That line, we held our circle as we had to do, feels so Frostian.
Well, there's a kind of imitation going on in some of the lines, isn't there? That's right. I mean, and I think any modern reader would, and clued-up reader would know that I was sort of imitating him as well as paying my respects to him.
There are a couple of other poems I just beg you to read. One, continuing the natural theme, but also a sort of homage to Ted Hughes, I take it, is a poem called The Fox Provides for Himself.
It is a sort of homage to Ted Hughes. I wrote it very soon after Ted had died. And, of course, I mean, it's an homage in the sense that one of Ted's most famous early poems is The Thought Fox. Having said that, it is based absolutely on sort of real experience. I was living at this stage in a house in London which had a longish, thin garden, and like a lot of London houses, it had a family of foxes living at the end of it. But it's not... There's one big difference between this poem and the Frost poem, which is whereas the Frost poem has a sort of smile on its face and knows that it's borrowing Frost's cadences and so on, this one is much more nearly a poem, as it were, by me, purely and simply by me, which has got its arm round a subject that we associate with Ted as a form of paying some respects to him. The title, The Fox Provides for Himself, comes from the Book of Job. There's a phrase in the Book of Job which is full of mysterious phrases, isn't it, which goes something like, the fox provides for himself, but the lion speaks only to God, which I take it means something along the lines of lions in their lordly way seem to have a hot line to the Almighty, but foxes, being lowlier creatures, have to look out for themselves. Mm. And it has quite an intricate rhyming scheme, this too, which nobody listening will notice, and that's fine by me. I just, okay. Since it took me ages to do it, I thought I'd mention it. It could have been an afternoon at the end of our lives. The children gone, the house quiet, and time our own. Without a word, we stalled at a window looking down. Weak winter sunlight sank through the beech tree next door, skimming the top of our dividing wall, spilling a primrose stain surprisingly far into our own patch. Earlier that same year, we had laid new grass, and the squares of earth underneath it all still showed like the pavement of an abandoned town, though the grass itself had done well, and from that angle looked white as the breeze admired it, while we simply went on standing there, holding hands now, trying to drown the faint dynamo hum of London and lift off into nowhere. Maybe we did drift a little. At any rate, something changed. A shadow worked itself loose at the edge of our world. Not a shadow. A fox. We saw it droop over the neighbouring wall and step, using the sun as a plank of solid wood, down through the air until, landing on all fours, it rolled sideways, this was no stumble, and stretched out, owning the place. Big for a fox, I thought, but said nothing, holding my breath. The sun burning so far into his coat, each bristle stood distinct, ginger everywhere, but in fact red, rising through brown, to black, to grey at the tip, like bare plant stalks dying towards the light, but of course soft, so I knew my hand would come away warm if I touched, and smelling of garlic. First he lay there, checking the silent earth with one ear, but soon the music started and he was up, a puppet living a secret life, stiff-spined but getting the hang of it, imitating all that he'd seen real foxes do and not been able, examining leaves, staring out flowers, then deciding to stop that. There was no danger here, only pleasure. And to prove it, he must fold his dainty front paws, stick his ramrod brush in the air, angle his plough-shaped mast to the grass, keep his back legs normal, and shunt himself slowly forward, inch by inch. Left cheek, then right, then left, then right again, smearing his mouth so far open, I saw the pegs of his teeth, the pink inside the gums flecked with black, before he tired of that too, and found under our laurel bush the children's football, a sorry pink and blue punctured thing, which must be killed now, now, and in one particular way, by flicking it smartly into the air, and as it fell, butting it almost too far to reach, but hoiking it back on invisible string, bringing death down in a frenzy of grins and delirious yaps. After that, silence again. When I returned to myself, the fox was upright, his coat convulsed in an all-over shrug, as if it were new and not fitting. Like a dog, when it jumps out of water and stands legs braced in a halo of dew, before trotting off in a hurry once more, which soon he did, back to the neighbour's wall. And as he leapt, he seemed to hang on the bricks, slackened, to show his skeleton must have somehow slipped from his body, or so I thought, watching the breeze reopen his fur and waiting to see how he dropped. Hardly a fox now, more like a trickle of rust. My hand still holding your hand as he went, then letting go.
Andrew Motion, I can't thank you enough for the mower, for your memoir, In the Blood, and for this conversation. Let's do it again.
Let's do it. It's a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Andrew Motion, who was England's Poet Laureate from 1999 to 2009. The Mower is the title of his new and selected poems. In the Blood, also just published in the States, is Andrew Motion's memoir of his childhood. Ben Mandelkern and Hannah Olson are the scouts and the readers who help produce these conversations with poets. Send your responses, send your poets, your poems, with a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.